And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowain. Now that Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett has released his proposed 2013 budget, the battle over who gets what is already underway. The governor's $28.4 billion plan is far less draconian than the last two, which proposed deep cuts to education and social programs. But this time around, the governor wants to increase funding for education and infrastructure, among other priorities. But there are significant strings attached, and that has many people wondering whether the governor will get the necessary support from the legislature. We'll look at what the budget means for taxpayers, lawmakers, and the governor's political career from two points of view. Donna Cooper is the executive director of the nonprofit Public Citizens for Children and Youth. PCCY has some major concerns about the new budget, particularly as it relates to improving the lives of children. Donna is lead researcher for Paul Volcker's State Budget Crisis Task Force and a senior fellow at the Washington-based Center for American Progress. Donna, welcome to Radio Times.
Great to be here, Tracy.
Also with us is Matthew Briette, president and CEO of the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The Commonwealth Foundation describes itself as a free market think tank and is generally supportive of the governor's spending plan. Matthew is a former high school teacher, current radio host, and he also serves as a columnist for the Central Pennsylvania Business Journal. Matthew, welcome to Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me, Tracy. Well, hi, Donna.
Hey, Matt.
Well, and I know that the two of you know each other and you've had discussions like this in the past, so we're looking forward to a lively hour and talking about the budget. Matthew, I'll begin with you. Tell us about some of the key points in this budget. What are some of the highlights as you see them?
Certainly. The key points in this is I think you first of all have to remember that government has no money of its own. So the $66 billion spending plan put forward by the governor is spending all of our money. It's money that families across Pennsylvania won't be able to spend on their own kids' health care or education or homes or transportation needs. So that's the first thing that we always have to remember when we're talking about budgets, is that this is our money that the politicians in Harrisburg are spending, and it's money that we can't spend on our own family needs. And so the governor has been able to hold the line on the spending increases that we certainly experienced in the previous administration. And this has been good for taxpayers because Pennsylvania has been creating jobs well above the national average in the last year. And even over the last 2 years, we've seen a significant surge in employment. This is what we need to improve our economy. It's not growing government and government programs, but creating jobs so that people can take care of themselves and their families.
Well, let me stop you and ask two things. You used the number $66 billion. Where does that come from?
Yes, this is the total combined spending of state and federal dollars that is allocated by our legislators in Harrisburg. We frequently talk about the general fund budget, which is the more fungible budget for politicians to divvy up, and that's about $28.4 billion. But there are significant monies that are spent that are in our transportation funds and federal dollars that flow into the state. So the total operating budget is over $66 billion.
Okay. Well, and let's talk about some of those highlights. And Donna, I invite you to jump in on this as well. We mentioned that there is some money earmarked for education, and we've seen some steep cuts in the last couple of budgets as it relates to education. So there's money that's going there, transportation and infrastructure. What are some of the other areas, Matthew, where that stand to benefit from this budget?
I'm sorry, were you asking me or Donna?
Yes, I'll start with you and then we'll have
okay.
Donna weigh in as well.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's important to remember that the so-called cuts in education were the loss of federal stimulus dollars, monies that we knew were only coming in for 2 years. And so the real cuts came from Washington that thankfully stopped those printing presses of fake money that flowed in to the Pennsylvania state budget. And it was actually a Governor Rendell that reduced the amount of state education revenue into public education. And it has only been recently that under Governor Corbett that we've seen it at record high levels of state funding in Pennsylvania. And so today we're looking at what would be the largest investment of state taxpayer money into education as well as into welfare, the two largest areas of our state budget.
Well, Donna, I'm thinking you may have a different spin on that, so I'd like to hear your thoughts about the money earmarked for education. And we want to point out, too, that you know there are a number of other issues here. There is talk about lifting the cap on the wholesale gasoline tax and the question of is that a tax or is it not a tax. There was a Medicaid offer, federal offer, that the governor has decided to pass on. There was news yesterday about the Pennsylvania lottery and the attorney general canceling the contract. So there are a lot of moving parts with this budget, and I want to make sure that we touch on those things. But Donna, I want you to respond to what Matthew has said about the money for education, because that's been a big issue over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame, because I think one of the premises of Matthew's comments is that what we each contribute in taxes, or what we pay in taxes, is money that is otherwise could be in our pocket to build my own road, build my own school, build my own post office. And I think that is a tired debate that the election of November put to rest for most Americans. So the fact is, when Pennsylvania passed its constitution, it said it should provide the resources necessary for a thorough and efficient education. And the creation of a public education system, specifically, I will say, the floor testimony in that was at that point only wealthy people were the very small number of people who were elected to create the state constitution. And they said, we worry about our sons, who will be wealthy by the fact that they are our sons, but they will not necessarily be educated. And it is for my son and everyone's son we should create a public education system, and we shall use the resources that we capture through taxation to make that possible. And I will say that it is accurate that the Rendell administration level funded education and used the stimulus funds to provide for the last 2 years of increase in public education money. Otherwise, our school districts would have had significantly more money than I believe they would have been able to absorb in that year. So responsible budgeting suggested that for the 2 years that the stimulus funds were there, the state funds would not be allocated for that purpose, specifically because we were in a recession. And that was the point of the stimulus. States are struggling. We don't want to lay off teachers. Let's use federal funds to temporarily give the states a break and preserve public education. And that's what they did. And unfortunately, we anticipated that the legislature would live up to its obligation as the economy rebounded. And what has happened, as we know, is in this region we've seen devastating education cuts as a result of $1 billion being taken out of the education budget over 2 years ago. Some money is being replaced this year, $90 million at face value, and perhaps another $200 million if the governor is successful in privatizing the state stores. And that will be new money, and that's needed. But we are so far behind what other states are investing in their schools and making it possible for kids to get a quality education. Now, money doesn't necessarily mean quality education, but when you don't have money, it's really hard.
Yeah. And here in the Philadelphia area, I'm just thinking about our school district and a projected deficit of something like $1 billion over the next 5 years. So how far do you think this money will go that's being allocated for education? How effective will that be relative to what the needs are?
Well, just in general, because school districts have to increase per state law the amount that they're spending on pension fund payments for retirees, school districts across the state have to spend about $380 million this year, starting in the academic year that starts on June 1st, for pension payments, $380. And the governor's proposed increase is $90. So school districts across the state are starting behind because of pension increases. And I think we need to live up to our pension promises. And if where we can make the pension system more efficient, we should do that as well. But in fact, the $90 million is basically going to be eaten up by districts to meet that $380 million pension increase that they have to pay for.
for.
We should mention, too, that Donna was a key policy advisor to Governor Rendell as it relates to education policy. And you mentioned, Donna, pensions, and that was a key point. In fact, Matthew, the governor said it may be the single most important thing that we do. And he's talking about changing the way that we do pensions now, particularly for new state employees, correct? How would that work?
Well, without a doubt, and Donna is absolutely correct, that the pension crisis that we're facing really across Pennsylvania at both the state level and in every single school district across Pennsylvania is going to consume pretty much any projected growth we have in state revenues coming in to help pay for those things. Over the next couple of years, if we do nothing, we are going to be increasing the costs or payments into the pension system by $500 million every year for the next couple of years. So we have to do something about this while also maintaining our commitments that we've made to our public school teachers and public employees that the benefits that they've earned, that they are going to get them, that they are protected. But going forward, we have got to take the example of the private sector that long ago moved away from defined benefit plans, where you have a guaranteed government income for life, and into defined contribution plans, where employees are the actual owners of their retirements, and they become much more portable, and we don't put golden handcuffs on people in public service, that they're able to move around. And in what is a 21st century here, people don't make a career for 30 or 40 years in one place anymore. These are the types of changes that we have got to address, and we have to do just from a financial standpoint, because all of our municipalities and cities and boroughs and townships are also dealing with the same problem. And it's going to be a very, very difficult lift. But the numbers just do not add up for us to be able to afford this.
Well, so Matthew, how would the governor's plan work? Are we talking about 401ks for future employees as opposed to the current system, or what is he proposing?
Yes, what the governor's proposed is that new employees at a certain date in the future, anybody hired would go into a 401k type program. It would be a little bit different than what you find in the private sector, but generally the concept is the same, that the employee makes a contribution, the employer, that being the taxpayer, makes a contribution, and that is then owned by the employee, and they are responsible and, of course, get help from just like folks in the private sector do in managing those funds. Then the governor has also proposed addressing those unearned benefits, meaning that if I'm still a state worker or a public school teacher, that if I've been in 10 years, well, I'm guaranteed those benefits I've earned after 10 years. But going forward, I'm going to have a reduced benefit because it was back in 2001 when you had a Republican governor, Republican House, Republican Senate, that they increased the multiplier for public school employees by 25% and state legislators by 50%. And so they are proposing a rollback of 25%, or I'm sorry, 0.5 for all employees. So this is what he plans going forward. It's going to be a rough and tumble fight, to be sure, though.
Well, I'm going to stop right there, Matthew. We need to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about Governor Corbett's proposed budget, the debate that is currently ensuing around that, and we'll take your calls as well when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, BigBlueMarbleBooks.com.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents the Summer Academy for High School Students, July 8th through August 2nd. Designed for motivated high school students intent on a fine arts education, the program features college-level courses in drawing, painting, sculpture, and printmaking, and trips to the galleries and museums of Philadelphia, New York, and Washington, D.C. Registration is now open, and space is limited. Details at pafa.edu/summeracademy.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Comedians are like flowers.
I think I may be the orchid of comedy. It takes years to really get a bloom going, but once you do, they're so beautiful. Oh, it got too hot.
Maria Bamford and her special, special, special on Bullseye from PRI.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY. Their annual rug event ends this week, featuring the Fair Trade Bunyad Rug Collection of over 1,500 hand-knotted rugs. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about Governor Corbett's proposed budget for Pennsylvania for 2013 and 14. And, of course, if you have been following the news, you know that it is controversial. It is not as austere as in years past by most accounts, but certainly there are some strings attached to some of the money that has been earmarked for various concerns. And so we've been debating the budget with Donna Cooper. Donna is Executive Director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth. She's also lead researcher for Paul Volcker's State Budget Crisis Task Force. She also, when Ed Rendell was governor of Pennsylvania, was policy chief for 8 years there, and was a deputy mayor under Ed Rendell here in Philadelphia for policy and planning. Our other guest is Matthew Briette, who is president and CEO of the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives, based in Harrisburg. They are a think tank there, and Matt is also a school teacher and school board member, former school teacher. Welcome back to both of you. We were talking about the pension issue, which is a big, big piece of the budget. And there are a couple of things there that we just want to flesh out. Before we do that, let me give the number for our listeners so that they can call in with their questions as it relates to the budget. The number is 888-477-9499. If you'd like to be part of our conversation and you've got questions for either or both of our guests. But let's pick up where we left off. We were talking about, Donna, the pension issue and how the governor has said that this is huge, that that is a big part of the budget, but also we were starting off talking about education and about how that money that's earmarked for education is contingent on sale of the state stores as well. So we want to talk about that because those are a couple of really big ifs.
Yeah, I mean, the governor's budget has two contingencies, the sale of the state stores and the change in pensions. And both of those are conversations that make sense to have. They're both conversations that affect organized labor, and they have significant impact on the economy and state revenues. So the state store generates a lot of money for the state budget, and then the pensions, obviously, for state expenditures. So they're big conversations we should have, but the governor has linked investments in children to successfully getting those two giant transformational efforts approved by the legislature. And so what the budget has done is set up the needs of investing in education and the future of the Commonwealth in our children against those, to some extent, of organized labor and retirees. Mm. And I feel like that's a very unfortunate way to approach this conversation, and one that is kind of a divide and conquer strategy that is, again, I think part of the politics that America has said they're tired of. If we want to talk about state store privatization, let's do it. But don't tell me that the fate of my child's elementary school is predicated on you successfully getting that, because that's a sandbox that's divisive, and I'm tired of being in that sandbox.
Matt, what do you say?
Well, it's interesting to hear Donna say that, because that was precisely the strategy Governor Rendell pursued when he would ask for when he asked for a 30% increase in the personal income tax to be able to spend more money on the very things that Donna is talking about. Then, of course, that didn't come through. He only got a 10%, and which wasn't good for our economy. But that is that's precisely the way that every governor has operated, is that they roll out their plans, make their proposals, and it's not unlike the plan that we supported for Governor Rendell when he said, let's lease the Pennsylvania Turnpike, and it would give us nearly $13 billion to invest in our roads, highways, and bridges. And we supported that and worked even with Donna to help bring that about. And boy, we were proved right, Donna, that would have been a far better deal than looking at a turnpike that's $8 billion in debt and tolls going up far greater than what Governor Rendell had secured with a company. So
I think there's a structural difference, though, in that, Matthew. I agree that the governor proposed plans to invest in education that were contingent on new revenues. But the premise of the new revenues was also for the fact that Pennsylvania is got one of the lowest personal income tax in the country. And so there was a reason for us, not just for education, to think about whether we're generating enough resources to support the needs of the Commonwealth. And in spite of the fact that we did not get the revenue increase we asked for, we put most of the education money into the budget at the end of the day. So I agree that it's always a political strategy. Can we do this and get that? And I applaud the governor's proposed wholesale change in the gas tax to fund the roads, $1.8 billion. And I would applaud the governor saying we should increase personal income taxes to pay for schools. What I think this does, though, is work on some sort of internecine politics between special interests that I think are divisive and make for a conversation that isn't as progressive or as substantive as I think we need to have in America.
Well, Matthew, let me ask you this. Do you think that there is enough support for the sale of the liquor stores, for starters? I mean, this is not the first time that this idea has come up. What is it that makes the governor think that now is the right time and that the support is there to do that?
Oh, when it comes to public support, it is very clear. In fact, we released a poll earlier this week done by a FM3, which Donna may be familiar with since they did a lot of work for Governor Rendell as mayor and as a Democratic National Committee chairman. Certainly they found with the most comprehensive survey that Pennsylvanians support this across the board, particularly in the Southeast. In fact, the more people use the current government-run system, the more they want out of it. And so no matter where you go, with the exception of Philly, and it's almost split even in the city of Philadelphia, but no matter where you go in Pennsylvania, people are saying, get government out of the booze business. So public support is there. Now, Donna has rightly noted that you will see organized labor opposition, particularly United Food and commercial workers who represent about 3,500 state store clerks. They want to maintain this prohibition era and keep Pennsylvania and Utah the only two states that have complete control of wine and spirit sales. Then you're also dealing with beer distributors who have their own little private monopolies and don't want to have any change. Some are saying, yeah, let's be able to sell wine and spirits, and our beer distributors will invest and see great economic opportunity. But there are a lot of those that are just not wanting to change with the times. But we'll see who wins out, if it's the public support that says do this, or the special interests that want to maintain the status quo. And, of course, it's going to take 102 in the House and 26 in the Senate to get it to the governor's desk.
Well, and that's the question, Matt. Does he have the legislative support?
Well, I think he does. I think that it's going to be difficult. Make no two. I won't make any bones about that. But in terms of all of the things that the governor has proposed, from transportation to pensions to liquor, if I had to rank them, and I'd be interested in Donna's thoughts, she's been in these battles in the past. If I had to rank them, I would say that liquor would probably be the easiest of all three of those issues.
Donna?
Yeah, I guess my thought is I think that there are three issues when it comes to the state store privatization. The first is that obviously we get a lot of sales tax money, which we would get under any system. And I think people who think prices are going to go down when we privatize will be proven wrong by looking at the experience in other states. The second is we get the profit transfer. As you know, we transfer money from the state store fund to the general fund, and it helps the state budget beyond the sales tax amount. And I think that is one of the biggest obstacles to privatizing, because we do rely on that money, and that will disappear. And the third is that I think there is a degree to which we need to think about jobs. I think, yes, there is this entrenched, organized labor opposition to this, and I think that they have their own self-interest. But I think as a society, I'm interested in creating opportunities where people are paid a decent wage and are paid benefits, because that helps me. My life is better when people aren't in poverty and when they have health insurance. And I don't think that will be sustained when we privatize the state stores. So it's an anomaly, but there's benefits to this anomaly that I think work for the Commonwealth and are are salient issues within the building that undermine the governor's ability to get the votes.
Well, let's go to the phones. In fact, let me give the number one more time for our listeners. If you'd like to join in our conversation, it's 888-477-9499. We will start off in New Hope with Beth. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, this is Beth from New Hope. I have heard the governor say that this budget proposes to spend the most state money on education that we've ever spent. But then I hear people on the other side saying that's not true. And since I think the state funding of education is the primary state responsibility under the Constitution, I'm confused by that. Can you address that?
All right. Well, thank you, Beth, for your call.
Well, I'll just jump in. Look, with the increase in state funding for the pension obligation for the school districts, it is the case that this is a very robust education budget, but hundreds of millions of that are needed to pay for the pension obligations for the teachers. And so the net new dollars that are on the table from the governor, uncontingent on any other changes in the budget, are $90 million, and that is a $900 million reduction in the amount of funds that went from the Commonwealth to school districts. Now, some of that money before had been federal, and now it's state. But the fact is, this is a lower amount of money from the Commonwealth to school districts than when the governor took office, without a doubt. But it is further, although it does include an increase of $90 million, that increase is a third of, or less than a third of what is needed for districts to meet their pension obligations. So we will not see investments in classrooms, and we will see continued and widening disparity between districts where there's lots of folks who are poor and have high property taxes, and people who live in other communities where there's greater wealth and also have relatively strong property tax bases. They can meet this obligation easier than poorer districts. So we'll see further erosion in the equity across our districts, and I worry about quality as well.
Beth, the real numbers in terms of the total state support for K-12 education, Governor Rendell's last budget put nearly $8.6 billion of state revenues. It relied upon $2.1 billion in federal revenues. Governor Corbett's first budget, he put $9.2 billion and has proposed over $10 billion. So it's definitely been an increase in state dollars. It has been the decline in federal dollars that, of course, we were warned that this was not going to continue forever. And so we have seen that this is the largest amount of state revenues. Now, of course, you take out that federal stimulus money, and then that's where you get those so-called cuts. But those were not Governor Corbett's cuts. Those were the cuts from the federal government transferring money to the states.
So what's the plan B if this doesn't work out as far as the pension changes are concerned, as far as the sale of the liquor stores and this money that has been geared toward these kinds of things? If that doesn't happen and the support isn't there, where are we then, Donna?
Well, I think that's a terrific question, and it's one I think the governor needs to answer because I'm not clear how he envisions meeting the obligations that he suggested without those changes. I also think that the conversation now has shifted to the legislature. The governor's made a proposal, and they also have to think about, do they think that the increase as proposed for public education is sufficient, given the pension changes? Do they think we are, how far do they think we are behind in meeting what is agreed upon as too small a funding in public education for the resources? Early childhood education funds, while increased modestly, are also woefully short. We're not making any progress on child health insurance. We'll be status quo from when the governor took office. So I think there's a lot of questions for every state House member and every state representative to grapple with. One of the things the governor's put on the table is privatized state store. That will generate one-time money. He's put on the changes in the pension fund, which over time will generate some money. But I think there's some tough questions for folks in that building, and I think the question of what is the option for new revenues. Now, I will say, Tracy, this budget has a $282 million fund balance. That means there's $280 million that has not been proposed to be spent anywhere yet. So one way out of Dodge is they use that money. I would think that's too easy a way out of Dodge. I would like to see us increase our resources for what we know are the investments that will boost the chances of kids throughout the region.
Matt, what's your take on that?
Yeah, well, of course, just like under Governor Rendell, when he proposed billions of dollars in new taxes and didn't get them, they had to go back to the drawing board and prioritize their spending and say, okay, what are the core functions of government? And, of course, you'd come up with transportation and education and public welfare. And how do we spend those monies that we have? And that's precisely what will happen over the next couple of months. And if the governor is not successful in privatizing the state stores or in the pension changes, they're going to have to figure out where that money where that money comes from. So it will be the prioritization of existing revenues. And that's an important point, I think, in all of these budgets, that the governor said, hey, we are the 10th highest taxed state and local taxes. The taxpayers are paying quite a bit. Let's spend that $66 billion of their money that we're spending better. Let's not ask for more from them, but let's get a better return on the investments we're already making.
Well, it sounds like if things don't go as planned, that one thing we know for sure is that legislators will have a long spring session into the summer prioritizing and figuring out where the money comes from if it doesn't go through as planned. Lots of other things that we want to talk about as it relates to this budget. Matt, there was the question about lifting the cap on the wholesale gasoline tax, and there are those who say that effectively is another tax and that consumers are going to see that at the pump eventually. Is it a new tax? How would you characterize that decision?
Well, it's certainly not a new tax. Of course, it's in place right now, nor are they talking about changing the rate of that tax. But they are talking about lifting the limits that currently exist to generate nearly $2 billion. That money has to come from somewhere, and it will likely be paid by, we, the consumers, those who drive, those who will end up paying this bill. So the notion that this is just going to be a tax on major corporations is always a false notion. I like to say that businesses don't pay any taxes, only people pay taxes. And we pay them in the form of higher priced goods or services, or those employed in those businesses pay for them through lower wages or benefits, or retirees pay for them in lower returns on the investments. A lot of pension funds are invested there, and that will have a negative impact on them. So anytime we talk about taking more money out of the private sector, no matter how good it might feel to say, well, let's stick it to Exxon or BP or whomever, we have to recognize that we ultimately pay for that, every one of us here in Pennsylvania. And so this is an approach that we would say transportation is a core function of government. We fully agree with that. And we also believe that people should pay for the government that they use. And the gas tax is one that has a more direct relevance to our utilization of the roads, highways, and bridges. But before we ask for another increase in revenue, we ought to make sure that we're spending the over $6 billion we already spend on infrastructure in Pennsylvania. We ought to make sure we're maximizing that. For example, we ought to get rid of prevailing wage, which everyone knows doesn't add to any greater quality of our roads, but it just is an artificial increase in the price that we have to pay to build our roads, highways, and bridges. Then we also ought to make sure
Matthew, let me stop you right there, because we actually have to take a break. So we'll come back and we'll pick up where we left off. I'd like you to finish your thought, and then Donna, I know that you have something to add to that as well. Talking about Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's proposed budget for 2013 and 14, and we'd love to hear from you as well when Radio Times comes back.
Abington Health supports WHYY and offers minimally invasive procedures designed to help people overcome strokes and brain aneurysms. Physicians use interventional techniques through small incisions to help speed recovery. Patient stories at abingtonpowertoheal.org.
It is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
On the next Fresh Air, Tony Kushner talks about writing the screenplay for Lincoln, and Wes Anderson talks about writing the screenplay for his film Moonrise Kingdom. Both screenplays are nominated for Oscars. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. An entrepreneur has an idea. Have towns seize underwater homes and sell them back to owners for less. But mortgage holders are not happy. Also, Karen Russell's critically raved about new short story collection. Where does she get these ideas? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from PNC Wealth Management, helping customers live achievement by crafting personalized solutions to grow, preserve, and transfer wealth. More information is available from John Conaway at 215-585-5438.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and we are talking about Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's proposed budget for the next fiscal year. We are debating the merits of that budget, and we've been talking with Matthew Briette, who is president and CEO of the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives, based in Harrisburg. Donna Cooper is with us as well. She's the executive director of Public Citizens for Children and Youth. And Matt, when we left off, you were finishing a thought. We were talking about the gasoline, lifting the cap on the wholesale gasoline, and whether that was a tax or not. And I want you to finish where you left off, if you would.
Yeah, I'll be real quick. In addition to addressing prevailing wage reform and better utilizing public-private partnerships, where we bring private sector capital into Pennsylvania and expertise to help us with our infrastructure needs, particularly in the mass transit area. And as it relates to mass transit, we need to adopt a more users pay approach. Certainly those who need financial assistance, we can provide vouchers and continue to subsidize their rides. But for people, say, in the top 1% of income earners, why do the taxpayers have to continue to subsidize their rides? They can pay for the true cost of those rides, and we need to adopt some reforms so that we stop sending money from our roads, highways, and bridges and into mass transit, and we have the more of a user pay and more where people who can afford to are actually paying for those rides. So these are the reforms that we believe need to be adopted before we ask the taxpayers to pay any more at the pump or through whatever scheme where we see coming out of Harrisburg.
Donna?
So, Matt, I think it'd be spectacular if the top 1% had a higher gas tax rate, too, because we're subsidizing the roads and the highways as well. But let me just say that I think Matthew did a spectacular job threading the needle for the governor so that he's out of the Grover Norquist no-tax pledge. Well done. I hope he uses your talking points on that. But what the good thing that Matt agrees with is that we should have a user pay system for our roads and highways and transit. I agree with that. I think that there are anomalies in those systems that drive a different user pay approach. But there are two things that Matthew suggested that prevailing wage and P3s need to be considered as well. Look, the fact of the matter is that the people who do this road work across the state, whether they're in unions or not, the surveys show, which are done every year by the Department of Labor, and Matthew knows this, that there isn't a big differential between the wages of those that are in unions or not. Prevailing wage is not about a union wage, it's the wage in the area. And when you look at road construction or school construction, with or without prevailing wage, you're not going to see much difference in cost. With P3s, you'll see speed, but you'll see more expensive projects. And I am not opposed to P3s. What that means is we take I-80 and we let a private company take the lease on that, they repair it, they operate it, they get the revenues from it. And I'm in favor of that because we do not have the capital to put up front to do that. But the fact of the matter is, over the long term, the cost of the tolls for I-80 will not only include the interest that I borrowed from that capital, from that company to build the road, but their profit. Again, I'm fine with it, but it's not that that is a more efficient way to do something. It's just a way to get it done. So I, again, suggest that we stop the tired ideological arguments and raising these sort of red herring issues and focus, and again, P3s are not an example where we're doing that. I think it's a way to get something done. But I think raising prevention prevailing wage is the same thing as suggesting tax money is money I couldn't spend elsewhere. Because as Matthew knows, the Federal Reserve of San Francisco pointed out that when you take a dollar and you put it into infrastructure investment in roads and highways, you get the greatest amount of economic activity of any other investment that can be made by the government or the private sector. That construction is an economic generator, and the multiplier effect of it is indisputable. And for that reason, if we want to get the economy back on track, we should be fixing our roads and doing this, and not spending a lot of time on esoteric red herring arguments.
Well, go ahead, Matthew.
Well, I'm not sure it's esoteric or red herring, because the reality is that we don't set wage levels for the procurement of any other services in government. When government contracts with Deloitte or with an IT firm or anything else provider, they don't say, here's what you have to pay your assistants or your technicians. We go to the marketplace and say, hey, what can you provide government's needs at a reasonable cost with the quality controls that will exist whether you've got prevailing wage or not. So when we look at highway infrastructure, that adds significant amount of money that could otherwise be spent in putting more roads in or filling more potholes. So it's not esoteric. It's, in fact, the reality that we don't need to be setting wages, but we ought to be pursuing the best quality for the lowest price for taxpayers.
The biggest input on cost of roads is concrete, cement, asphalt, and steel. They're the largest cost of road construction.
Indeed.
So let's focus on things that move the ball ahead rather than these marginal, small arguments that are not materially going to change anything, but represent an ideological divide.
If you're talking about 10% of over $6 billion, that is real money that would otherwise...
You won't zero out set 10%.
Well, let's do this.
Eliminate that cost.
Speaking of getting the ball rolling, there are a number of other topics that I'd like for both of you to talk about before our hour is away from us. And in fact, we want to stop back at the phones for just a moment because we have a question on pensions. Let's go to Wilmington, Delaware, and welcome Janice to our conversation. Hi, Janice.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, my question is, I am a retiree in the Pennsylvania system of 36 years in a public school setting, and my question is, has there been any thought or reform towards better monitoring of the spending for retirees returning to the public sector to work while they're receiving their pension? Now, I do understand that we can come back and make a certain amount of money in salary within the public sector, or the district has difficulty finding someone for a particular position. But my observation has been there are a lot of individuals who are returning, particularly teachers who retired in the regular public school system and going to charter schools to work, and there are people coming into interim positions who are actually making more money since they retired while receiving their retirement. And I think that if they monitor this and sort of enforce what they have in place for people returning to collect money from the same pot, would be a tremendous help in saving some funds within the pension plan. And this would truly help those who coming in to enjoy a pension like people like myself are doing.
Well, Janice, thank you for your call. Matt, what do you say?
Well, I'm not real sure about what it is that Janice is talking about or any abuses that are there. Of course, retirees are welcome to continue to work. Now, if we're talking about like a drop program, a deferred retirement option, we've found certainly that has put unbelievable stress and on our pension systems and made it very lucrative. So I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about, Janice, or something else.
No, I'm talking exactly. We just don't call it the drop with public education. But, yeah, I'm talking about that. For example, say a person is like 82 years of age who's retired, then retired, and there's an interim position making over $200,000 and receiving a pension. So, you're saying that's quite a bit of money. Number one, why would a person be coming back to work 180 days because that alone is against the pension system because you're only supposed to be able to work so many days. But, yes, let's talk about it in terms of the drop system.
Yeah, and I will say that the governor has proposed some of these kinds of limits that have been that have exacerbated the problem. And I know that that's part of his proposal for going forward is to limit those types of things that put undue stress on the pension plans and makes it much more difficult to manage.
Well, let's talk about a couple of other things before we wrap up our hour. One front page item in today's newspapers, and that is about Attorney General Kane and how she has rejected a contract for the private management of the Pennsylvania Lottery. Donna, how do you view that? What does that mean for Governor Corbett, and what's the significance of that?
Well, I think it's highly significant. It's a very unusual move and one that I think was most likely taken with an awful lot of thought and deliberation because it's an unusual move. I think that the privatization of the lottery was one where it's quite different than, for instance, the privatization, as we talked about, with the roads, because in this case, we had a very highly functioning lottery operation that in gross and net was doing better than nearly anywhere in the country for a couple years, probably the best in the country. And the firm coming in did not have, in my estimation, the track record to evidence it was going to do better than what we're doing. So I think that every part of government can get more efficient. It scares me to think that one of the places that's generating extraordinary returns was going to be privatized. I think we need to look at those options where we're not doing well, not where we're doing well. So that is sort of my take on this, and I give the Attorney General credit for taking a really tough move. It's certainly unusual and one that's going to cause a lot of debate in Harrisburg. Yeah.
Matt, what do you say?
Well, it's unfortunate because really the real losers in this are going to be the seniors utilizing programs from the lottery as well as taxpayers. And the reason I say that is, first, this was not a privatization in the sense that we were turning over the lottery or selling the lottery to a private firm. This was really just bringing in a private management group. And the lottery has done this. They have contracted with consultants and other private operators. So apparently the Attorney General has drawn an arbitrary line in the sand and said, well, this is just too much contracting out because this hasn't been ruled unconstitutional in the past. And it was under the purview of the Secretary of Revenue. We won't get into all the legal arguments going forward, and we'll see if Governor Corbett continues that. But the reality is that the lottery is going to have increased demands placed on it because of our growing senior population. And when you look at the historical performance of the lottery, what you found is that this company was going to come in and guarantee revenues for the next 20 years that would exceed historical performance of the lottery by $3 to $4.5 billion. And basically the company, the only way that they would make money is if they exceed the revenue guarantees to the Commonwealth. And they put up $200 million to guarantee that. And where this has been done in Illinois, they have exceeded the monies that the previously government-run and operated lottery had done. And so this, to us, is a big loser for the taxpayers and seniors because there are no guarantees for revenue in the future. And if they dip, we're either going to see cuts in those programs or higher taxes for working families.
One last question that I'd like both of you to address, and that is that while the consensus has been that this has been a kinder, gentler budget than we've seen in recent years, there are those, Matt, who say that this was sort of the beginning of the governor's reelection campaign, that it was strategically delivered this way and structured this way so that the governor will be able to perhaps increase his popularity ratings and get himself started on his campaign for reelection. What do you say about the politics of the budget?
Yes. I mean, that is the reality. It doesn't matter where you're at. Our elected officials are always thinking about election. It's not unlike Governor Rendell getting billions of dollars in borrowed money and then doling that out across the state in advance of the next election. And this is the way it has always worked. It will probably always continue to work. And so the notion that we can separate policy and politics, that sounds great in theory, but we know that reality says, hey, we're always looking to how to leverage opportunity in the public discussion.
Donna?
You know, what's heartening to me is that the fact that the governor's strategy to increase his popularity rests on increasing in public education, investing in public education in early childhood. So I'm happy that he's got to think about his popularity, and I'm happy that he thinks that part of addressing his popularity is to invest in kids. I don't think this is going to make him popular enough. He needs to invest more in kids. He needs to think about how we have a fairer state revenue system so we have the resources available to invest in kids. That will make him more popular.
Is he likely to win re-election in your view, Matt, as you look ahead to the next election? He's had some struggles with that. What do you think his prospects are at this point?
He has, and I think that even somebody who supported Governor Rendell is hoping so as well. David Cohen has recently endorsed Tom Corbett's reelection, and he has said that his budgets have been humane, and he has done a good job. And so that you have an endorsement from a very prominent person who worked for Governor Rendell's efforts and even President Obama, and is yet saying, This is a good man, that he is doing the best he can, and he is, I think the numbers have demonstrated with our job growth, which is really where we need to be saying this is how we make sure that we have the greatest shared prosperity across Pennsylvania, is growing jobs and allowing people to take care of their families and pay for their health care, their kids' education. This is what will make us a better society, not just growing government, making government work better. Nobody, you know, Donna likes to think that I want to give back all $66 billion. No, I'm saying we need to prioritize the money we're already spending before we start asking families to pay more and more for programs that may or may not be delivering on their promises.
And Donna, what happens next? Now that the debate has begun, the proposals are out there, what's next?
Well, I mean, there's going to be budget hearings in Harrisburg, and to some extent, those budget hearings are an opportunity for people to weigh in and say, this isn't good enough. But really, what happens is people call their senators and they call their House members, and they say whether they think this is good or bad, and then there's a struggle between the House and the Senate and the governor's office. And I think more people are engaged, the better. And the challenge for us as the state is to figure out how we make real improvements in public education, and that depends on more resources and more accountability.
Well, let the struggle begin. Donna Cooper from Public Citizens for Children and Youth, thank you so much for being with us.
Great
on
to be
Radio
with you, Tracy.
Times. Matthew Briette, it was a pleasure having you as well. You are President and CEO of the Commonwealth Foundation for Public Policy Alternatives. Thanks for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Muscoane.